Hyperion to a satyr.
Welcome to the 19th episode and third season, yes, of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, your guide on a scene-by-scene deep dive look at Shakespeare's masterwork through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations. Today we begin Act 3, Scene 1, and once again we have a scene that's too long to cover in one go. I'll split it into three. Briefings, in which Rosencrantz and Guildenstern brief Claudius and Gertrude on what they've learned from Hamlet, after which Ophelia is instructed to bump into the prince. Next week, we'll look at the to-be-or-not-to-be speech, and then after that, the nunnery scene in which Hamlet meets Ophelia, not at all by accident, while being observed by Claudius and Polonius. So let's take a look at that first sequence, starting with the text itself. Intriguingly, the scene starts in medias res. The "and" in the line, "and can you, by no drift of circumstance," certainly suggests that the briefing has been going on for a bit, and that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern have yet to submit new information. This is interesting because, for the rest of the sequence, R and G play for time, attempt to ingratiate themselves, and are generally desperate to please. Might we understand the king to be impatient with them already? If there's a part of the briefing we were not privy to, it strengthens both sides' motivations. And if Claudius is not yet impatient with them in the text, he soon will be at their next meeting. Let me read from the exchange. Queen Gertrude says, "Did he receive you well?" Rosencrantz, "Most like a gentleman," Guildenstern, "but with much forcing of his disposition." Rosencrantz, "Niggard of question, but of our demands, most free in his reply." It's an example of RNG's doublespeak. Each twin has his own strategy to please the court. Rosencrantz doesn't want to rock the boat, and perhaps especially in Gertrude's presence, covers any intimation of Hamlet's wrongdoing with praise. Guildenstern, for his part, is more straightforward and honest, trying to do a good job for the king rather than play the sycophant. So while the joke is that the two of them are interchangeable, they do offer different takes for the cunning actor. Though film versions will often play with the timeline of the play, Shakespeare clearly tells us here that Act 3 takes place the day after Act 2, and that the Mousetrap is set to be played this night. In Act 2, Hamlet says, "We'll hear a play tomorrow," and hear the sycophants say, "The play is tonight." Polonius enters. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern exit. Claudius and Polonius ask Gertrude to leave as well so that they can hide themselves behind an arras and send Ophelia Hamlet's way. "For we have closely sent for Hamlet hither." Now, this is a line that we hardly ever think about, but it could prove important. Hamlet has been sent for so that Ophelia can accidentally intercept him. This may have a role to play in any given actor's decision to play To Be or Not to Be as a performance from Hamlet. Does he know he's being watched? The fact that he's heading to a destination he's been called to could mean he strongly suspects. That he, as twere by accident, may there affront Ophelia. Affront. That's an interesting word. It means meet face to face, but it does prefigure the affront of Hamlet's attack upon Ophelia. "Her father and myself, lawful espials." Claudius, ever the politician, paints himself as a lawful spy. Whatever the king does is law, after all. This may also connect to his justification for killing Hamlet Sr. Did he think it the right thing to do at the time? Since we don't know much about Hamlet's father, except the unreliable praise filtered through the prince's own recollections and the rather nasty ghost he has become, perhaps Claudius was justified. Or perhaps he just has the kind of mind that allows him to justify any action. So they go over the plan. Gertrude leaves after giving Ophelia her blessing, and then we get our first confirmation that Claudius did indeed commit fratricide. Polonius says, "We are oft to blame in this. 'Tis too much proved that with devotion's visage and pious action we do sugar o'er the devil himself." He blames himself for cutting Hamlet off from his daughter and therefore for the prince's madness, though he meant well. Polonius's regret brings out Claudius's own guilt in an aside. "Oh, 'tis too true how smart a lash that speech doth give my conscience. The harlot's cheek, beautied with plastering art, is not more ugly to the thing that helps it than is my deed to my most painted word, O heavy burden. In effect, the audience confirms, before Hamlet does, that Claudius is a villain. Calling his words painted covers everything that went before with a veil of irony. Words like lawful and frankly and his contentment over Hamlet's interest in theater may all be false. The aside retains a certain measure of ambiguity, however. Claudius does not actually confess the murder here. We only believe he does because that's what Hamlet accuses him of. And that's where our loyalty lies. Polonius accuses himself of meddling under the guise of piety and devotion, and so that's the only thing Claudius really admits to. As a politician, he too has sugared over his political manipulations with high-sounding words, his speech at the wedding banquet, for example, or even his false concern over Hamlet being actually motivated by a desire to keep his queen happy. But would those things be a heavy burden? Note also that Ophelia does not exit, and in a stage production, one should expect her to be lurking on stage during To Be or Not To Be. Unnoticed? And will this mean she overhears the suicide speech? In films, greater distance can be placed between characters, not locked to a relatively small space, but as we'll see, some directors chose to keep the stage directions as intended. These are some of the issues facing actors and directors as we head into their interpretations of the sequence. As usual, we start our exploration of adaptations with Branagh's 1996 version. Here, an impatient and even angry Claudius enters, followed by the scene's other participants, including Ophelia, who we often easily forget is present during Rosencrantz and Guildenstern's debriefing. Perhaps because the sequence is cut into separate scenes in other versions. But as written, she hears their report, which may well play into a certain anxiety or fear when she soon after meets Hamlet. The way Jacoby plays Claudius here, this line,
"And can you by no drift of confidence get from him why he puts on this confusion?"
definitely sounds like an accusation. Does he suspect him of faking? As this scene reveals, Claudius himself is guilty of something, so his paranoia may be responsible for his mistrust of Hamlet's madness, and his real reason for trying to find out what's causing it. All he gets is ambivalence from RNG, the pair going back and forth on whether Hamlet is mad or not, which, to be fair, is the same back and forth presented by Hamlet himself. Faced with the king's frustration, which seems to distract him, as much as Hamlet is distracted, the king and prince are each other's obsessions. The brown-nosing Rosencrantz here takes implicit credit in the player's effect on Hamlet.
"Madam, it so fell out that certain players we all wrought on the way, of these we told him, and there did seem in him a kind of joy to hear of it."
Meanwhile, the camera spins around the actors, a manifestation of their continued confusion, but also a way to create suspense for the coming violence. Ophelia, tellingly, is left alone under some stairs, stranded. She will be the victim of that violence, but for now is unseen, allowing Hamlet to embark on his famous soliloquy, while she's as much a spy as Claudius and Polonius are. As for Gertrude, she's dismissed, and we may ask ourselves, why? Does Claudius mean to hide his findings from her? Is he protecting her from what he feels could be an explosive situation? There's a sense, especially in her looks, that she's being manipulated here. As we'll find out later, Claudius already has made his mind up, and he will brook no alternate interpretation.
"It is too much proved that with devotion's visage and pious action we do sugar o'er the devil himself."
"Oh, it is too true. How smart a lash that speech doth give my conscience. The harlot's cheek, beauted with plastering art, is not more ugly to the thing that helps it than is my deed to my most painted word. O heavy burden."
Polonius, in earnest, chides himself by using the "we" that links him to Claudius. Both are parents, although Claudius is a false one, biologically and morally. In the aside that follows, Jacoby makes Claudius a sympathetic figure, a good man who gave in to temptation and went wrong. This ambiguity is one of the reasons this version pleases me so much. We completely believe in his remorse, though it doesn't change a thing. It's something that is revisited in the confessional scene. And the sense of urgency is maintained in the second part of the sequence as the characters must hustle to their places as Hamlet approaches. A shot of Ophelia standing behind a small section of wall reminds us of her presence, and the stage is set for the most famous words in the English language. As Rosencrantz and Guildenstern do not appear in Olivier's version from 1948, only Ophelia need be briefed. And as To Be or Not to Be is actually uttered in Act 2, we'll still cover it in the text order next week, of course, she need not be subjected to overhearing it. So what are we left with? Quite an interesting piece of staging, actually. The innocent Ophelia's status as a victim is emphasized in the film. She comes down a corridor, unawares, and is ambushed by her father just as he intends her to ambush Hamlet. His hand, holding a book, comes out of nowhere and surprises her. A violent penetration into her interior world. This Ophelia has not been prepared for what is to come, which will add to her confusion and the unfairness of the situation. It's very cleverly done. Once she gets her instructions, Polonius and the king go behind an arras, though not before Polonius points repeatedly at the spot where he wants her to stand. As ever, he means to control members of his family, something he has in common with Claudius, actually. Though once he's hidden, Ophelia is left to mill around, despondent. In Ophelia's every movement, there is discomfort. She's going back and forth in her own mind as to whether she should or even could disobey her father. The decision is taken out of her hands when Hamlet finally enters, startling her. In 1980's BBC adaptation, a variety of attitudes is on show early in the sequence, which is what makes it interesting. Rosencrantz and Gertrude are as expected, he with a certain defensiveness and she with sadness and worry. Guildenstern, for his part, almost chuckles at Hamlet's craft.
Nor do we find him forward to be sounded, but with a crafty madness keeps aloof when we would bring him on to some confession of his true state.
Showing some admiration for how the prince has prevented them from succeeding. This is self-serving in a sense. They only failed because Hamlet is so clever, but could also be perceived as a lack of loyalty to the king, which makes Rosencrantz's defensiveness flare up. As for Claudius, I always had misgivings about the way Patrick Stewart played him, but some of them are reformed by this analytical scene-by-scene viewing. I might now understand the actor's choice to disconnect Claudius from his emotions, though it had at first seemed false. But Claudius is false, and so playing him that way is legitimate. It's like he doesn't mean anything he says here, and may well be putting on a show for Gertrude when he expresses happiness at Hamlet's play. Does he even mean his aside? Polonius only laughingly chides himself here, as ever missing the point and being jolly about serious matters, which makes Claudius's guilty turn more severe in tone. But Stuart holds back. He doesn't seem to feel the guilt, only to recognize that he remembers the murder and that he has ever since lied about it.
The harlot's cheek, beauted with plastering art, is not more ugly to the thing that helps it than is my deed to my most painted word.
His crime is so horrific that he dare not connect to his emotions. He doesn't mean it will be an apt phrase to recall when he asks God for absolution. When he asks Gertrude to leave, he searches for the right words, painting him as a liar there too. Claudius's attitude leads me to ask whether the plan to send Hamlet to England is already in motion. In a few minutes, Hamlet will have played the savage with Ophelia, and Claudius will state in quick determination he's made a decision. But it's so quick, it might already have been on his mind. In other words, he doesn't want Gertrude there so he can come to this foregone conclusion no matter what. Hamlet just happens to give him cause. And in the category of line readings that inform the text, I'd like to mention,
"Good gentleman, give him a further edge and drive his purpose into these delights."
His emphases reveal some delicious ironies in the words. On the one hand, Shakespeare has Claudius use a violent metaphor where none should apply, entreating Hamlet to enjoy working on his play by turning him into a weapon. And on the other, Claudius doesn't know that the play is a weapon against him. Hamlet's added lines are the whetting of a blade that will eventually lead to a very real sword driven into the king. He's ordering his own murder and doesn't know it. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern's debriefing is played silently in Zeffirelli's vision, with them running up to the king while Hamlet looks on, unseen, and is moved to utter what words of the "Oh, what a peasant slave am I" speech the film retains. This makes their treachery more brazen and or gauche, which always has the perverse effect of weakening Hamlet. It's no great achievement to outplay the too incompetent RNG. Ophelia's own briefing takes place well before. To be or not to be and the nunnery scene are placed at the end of Act 2, just after the words sequence, and is missing the front end of the conversation. We begin here at Gertrude's "I do wish that you're good beauties," which has a strange effect of giving Gertrude control over the scheme. Though the queen treats Ophelia with much affection, she looks over the girl's shoulder at Polonius, as if instructing him, as well as his daughter, or perhaps letting him know that he's on the hook for his theory. Gertrude then has a silent moment with her husband as Ophelia and Polonius go down the stairs to the lobby. Hands are kissed and cheeks stroked before Claudius leaves her too. She stands at the top of the stairs a moment before leaving. That position of power again seems to point to a more manipulative queen, at least pushing for this ploy against her son. She does not obey Claudius, but seems to command him to do her dirty business. She means well, of course, but it does put her role in court politics into question. While perhaps not aware of Claudius's crime, how much did she actively seize the moment when she allied herself with him? Another important cut, Claudius does not make his confessional aside. Zeffirelli does his best to take away any kind of regret from the character. His Claudius is a more obvious and one-dimensional villain, unfortunately, and it would not do to make him more sympathetic, with even the perception of pangs of regret. In Hamlet 2000, we get into the sequence through the invitation to the mousetrap, the title of Hamlet's film within a film, spoiled a good while before it normally is in the text. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are on the phone with the king, speaking the single line, "We shall, my lord," together, comically.
"We shall, my lord."
It's an efficient piece of modern staging, putting great distance between the royals and the sycophants, and playing on the duo's sameness by having them huddle around the same phone, at least in our imaginations. While that is going on, Polonius is strapping a wire onto Ophelia, yet another piece of modern technology used to simulate the Elizabethans behind an heiress technique. There's something rather creepy and hilarious at the same time about all this. Polonius winking at the royals as he seemingly fondles his own daughter, the gesture made more inappropriate by the royals ogling the situation lasciviously. There is, in fact, something very sexual about Gertrude in this adaptation. Here she's halfway sitting on her husband and talking about Ophelia's virtues in ironic quotation marks.
"Sir, shall I hope that your virtues will bring him to his wonted way again?"
She seems to infer that Ophelia's power over Hamlet is sexual, and that all her son really needs is a good role in the hay. This Gertrude is someone who solves her problems with sex, having promptly changed her widow's fortune into a wedding, and definitely enjoying the honeymoon period. There is no real affection for Ophelia here. It's about using the girl as a sex object, if not to fix Hamlet, then at least to get information from him. There are a lot of lines cut from the sequence. We come in late on the phone conversation, and the modern spin must avoid mentioning certain anachronisms. But the most important are Ophelia's. She has no lines at all, remaining silent and weeping through the entire ordeal. Cutting "I wish it may" makes her a more unwilling participant in the scheme and supports her later suicide, making the royals and her father share in the responsibility along with Hamlet. The cuts also support the idea that the meeting will not be accidental. Ophelia will have to go to Hamlet while the older men listen in on the conversation. It also means that they won't hear "to be or not to be," nor will they be able to see what's going on. But those are all matters for the next time we pick the adaptation up, and I won't spoil them here. Fodor's experimental Hamlet. Okay, the conspirators are in a dark space, made stranger by often abstract angles, watching Hamlet practice his fencing from behind a two-way mirror. There is much to learn about the characters as Fodor imagines them here. The camera follows glances from Polonius' chest to Claudius' eyes, for example, and the two characters are sometimes standing next to each other, sometimes have Gertrude between them. Continuity mistake? No, the effect is to make the queen's relevance intermittent at best. Even Ophelia, naive in the way she gazes at Hamlet, gleefully smiles at the end of the sequence when the queen notices, powerless, that Polonia and Claudius are holding hands. The queen knows of her husband's infidelities, but bears them and the scorn and the ridicule of the entire house. This is a world with far more palpable corruption, and one gets a sense from these events that the king is not so much doing things for Gertrude as he is for Polonia. Polonia's motivation is manipulation for manipulation's sake, or simply to do evil. She drugs her sister to control her, keeps her away from Hamlet, and is now bored with that, and tries something else. Hamlet is either the object of a certain vengeance, he and Horatio have humiliated her with the truth of their words, a more distracted older Polonius would probably not react like that, or a pretext for getting closer to the king. The idea that she's in control here is presented visually by having Rosencrantz and Guildenstern seem to speak to her more than to the king. The king isn't in the frame, and Polonia, being closer, becomes the most powerful, which is to say largest, figure on screen. RNG are less sycophantic in this version. They just share Polonia's evil bent. In fact, only Gertrude, in any way, smiles. The others are all cold and calculating. They report their findings while watching Hamlet as if he were some laboratory animal.
There did seem in him a kind of joy to hear of it.
That's said with the voice of a scientist, observing an intriguing behavior. Polonia entreats the king to...
Feach me to entreat your majesties to hear and see the matter.
What sounds like a further variable. There is no sincerity in Polonia's voice. She essentially says, let's see what happens when we humor him. It's an experiment. Hamlet ends his practice with an unnamed character and tells his sparring partner that he fights like a girl. Now, this is a departure from the text. It has an ironic bent, since Hamlet's adversaries in the play include two women, three actually in this adaptation, and is about to have a confrontation, possibly violent, with one of them. He then goes on to the two-way mirror to fix his shirt. Ophelia looks right into his eyes, unseen. She's a manipulator too, though her goal may be different. She's happy to be part of this plan and will not show the doubt and fear other Ophelias have been prone to. As he lies down to rest in the white room, Ophelia leaves the dark one and joins him. Now in the David Tennant version, this sequence sits right on top of the film's structural change. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern's debriefing acts as a preamble to Claudius's reaction to the nunnery scene, and so as a way to get back to the timeline as written, because Ophelia's instructions, precursor as ever to be or not to be, and the nunnery scene, occur long before, in Act 2, just before the fishmonger scene. But we're addressing them together on the show, you know, in text order. That restructuring means that by the time RNG get to Claudius, the king has already seen Hamlet throwing Ophelia about and playing games with Polonius. As in the original text, being aware of all this means he's primed and ready to send his stepson to England. He's made up his mind. While RNG make their report, the king and queen simply use each consecutive argument to justify their opinions. When there is talk of crafty madness, Claudius wags his finger in an I told you so motion at Gertrude, but she, in turn, asks leading questions that have an unspoken yet audible yes but behind them. Yes but, did he receive you well? She's building a defense for her son, and is happy when the answers go her way, discomfited when the other twin puts a different spin on the same answer. The staging reveals why RNG each take a side. In the story, one is sucking up to the queen and the other to the king. In the drama, the royals are enacting their argument through the sycophants. By their reactions, the king and queen are suggesting answers to two people who only really want to say what the royals want to hear, and so they do. With Ophelia too, there is innovation from the cast and director Gregory Doran. It seems that in this version, Gertrude doesn't know Ophelia at all. She's unsure about the girl's name and says it with a question mark attached.
And for your part, Ophelia? Oh, I do wish that your good beauties be the happy cause of Hamlet's wildness.
And then lets out a surprised little oh when Ophelia takes her hand. There's no doubt her heart is warmed by the gesture and that her words are sincere, but they are not born of a long-standing affection. What does it mean? Well, she doesn't know her son as well as she thinks she does, for one thing. For another, it lends weight to Polonius and Laertes warning Ophelia away from Hamlet at the start of the play. Was he perhaps a bit of a lad, at least before Ophelia? his mother doesn't seem to keep up with who the latest girlfriend is, and what will be the impact of this choice on Gertrude's description of Ophelia's suicide.
So shall I hope your virtues will bring him to his wonted way again, to both your honors.
As it's often played, I just not considered another possibility, this line seems to refer to the honors of both Ophelia and Hamlet, that if love is the cause of Hamlet's madness, then the truth of it would heal both he and Ophelia. This Gertrude is more direct in addressing the line to Polonius, which makes more sense, actually. It would be to Ophelia's honor that she be the object of his love or madness, and to Polonius that his theory be correct. As Gertrude is dismissed and the scene turns to instructions for Ophelia, we see Hamlet coming down an adjacent corridor, the words echoing quite clearly. He's heard it all and definitely knows he'll be watched in the nunnery scene. However, to be or not to be is still spoken quietly enough to register as unheard by the spies. A word on Hamlet's t-shirt, as it's its first chronological appearance. Apparently an old t-shirt of Tennant's. It's a bit flashy for the dark, brooding Hamlet, but it takes on an ironic meaning. It's a drawn-on, muscled chest. I think it relates to Hamlet's earlier comparison between himself and Hercules. We're invited to compare the mythic demigod with the thin, disturbed boy in front of us. A Hyperion and a satyr, you know. One final thing, there's a hilarious bit when Polonius takes the book Ophelia is to read from a large folder. In this hyper-surveillance world, did Polonius catalog, index, and file all of Hamlet's mementos to Ophelia? It's as ludicrous and self-important as the First Minister himself. The only other adaptation we follow that includes the scene is Classics Illustrated, but not the 1952 version. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are given a mission, but we never see them on it, nor do they report back to the king. And as for the setup to Ophelia's encounter with Hamlet, space considerations leave it to the plan, being first mentioned in Act 2, and that's it. Tom Mandrake's more modern adaptation, however, gives the sequence a full and unusually sunny page. Space is still a concern, which cuts both in dialogue and images, changing the staging of the sequence. RNG's report, for example, now amounts to a single line. He does confess himself, and does not include the invitation to the mousetrap. This omission actually highlights an irony in the play. As written, Claudius makes a show of happiness to hear Hamlet has found joy in the players. He then goes on to spy on the prince and set things in motion for his exile. Here, there's no false show of emotion, and that's perhaps because Gertrude has been cut entirely from the scene. Classics Illustrated has decided that that joy is false. Compressing so much dialogue into so few panels has a powerful effect. It rushes things. There is greater momentum to the story, but also changes how we might perceive any given exchange. For example, it here looks like Claudius is informing RNG of his plans for Ophelia. And while most stagings of the play have made Polonius say his "we are off to blame in this" speech to Claudius, sharing the "we," here he says it to Ophelia, a rare apology for the character. It's just the way the characters are placed on the page. There's no space for, or any compositional advantage to, panels with the correct expressions or facing characters correctly to interpret each exchange and nuance. We'd need many more panels to do that. So reading these comics, it's clear that Hamlet is a drama meant to be acted. And, well, that ends our look at Act 3, Scene 1, Part 1. Next week, it's a big one, To Be or Not to Be, the most famous speech in the English language, perhaps in all of literature. In the meantime, if you have thoughts on this particular episode, please head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com. Leave them there. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/fwpodcasts and helping out with the hosting for all of these shows. Thanks for listening, and I hope you, dear listener, will return for Act 3, Scene 1, Part 2, To Be or Not to Be.
The rest is silence.